Welcome. The program is Arts Desire. I'm your host, Julie Motz. And now, even though this is an Arts Desire day, we're going to be talking about mathematics. But perhaps mathematics in a way you haven't considered it before. Mathematics perhaps from an artistic or a more overwhelming vision. I have with me Michael Schneider, whom I first met through a wonderful book he wrote called An Insider's Guide to Constructing the Universe. And that was when I had gotten interested in sacred geometry and someone had directed me to Michael's group and book. And it was an exploration of numbers in a way I'd never experienced them before. And that allowed me to begin to relate very personally to numbers. Michael followed it up with a wonderful DVD called Constructing the Universe. It's Constructing the Universe, a Journey from 1 to 12. We might say a journal and a journey. It says, learn to read the language of simple numbers and shapes in nature, science, technology, and symbolism. But what Michael really does is penetrate numbers as quality as well as quantity. So they begin to take on the dimension that they had for us, that they had for the ancients. And most recently, he's written a book called Fibonacci Series, Mathematics in the Plant World, which is the subtitle is Learn About Nature's Mathematical Growth. It's really about a very special collection of numbers you might say the Fibonacci series, and how, for reasons we don't know, or maybe Michael can explain, they are used by nature over and over again, and give us a certain feeling of calm and connectedness when we're in the presence of anything designed, you know, in these terms. So I really wanted to start out, just first of all, by asking you, Michael, how you got interested in numbers.
Well, hi, Julie. Thanks for inviting me here. I love coming out to beautiful, magical West Marin. How I got first interested in numbers, oh, my goodness. You know, I remember as a child in school, I was not a great math student. I was okay. I was average. I did the work. I did the workbooks and so forth. It was nothing special for me. But I do remember sitting there wondering, you know, what are numbers? What is that? What does plus really mean? What does minus really mean? And so on.
And was there anyone at that time who could answer these questions for you?
Oh, no. No. It took until I was about 16. I guess I was in high school. And somehow the idea of math and nature took hold, and I really caught fire with it. I thought, why are these numbers and shapes in nature? What is this about? You know, the spirals and squares. You know, the way Galileo put it was the universe is a vast book. And it's written in an alphabet of simple shapes, circles, triangles, squares, spirals. And if you want to read nature, you can read it like a book, the book of nature. And the idea caught me pretty hard, and I kept on investigating it, and I spent a lot of time. Wherever I went to the library, whatever town I was in. I grew up in and around New York City, so I spent a lot of time in the public library there, and you know, I found books written 1912, 1917, that sort of thing, where people discussed this sort of thing. But it wasn't done in modern times. And so I started organizing my thinking just for myself. And I thought sooner or later I'm going to come across this book that's going to explain to me everything that I want to know. Why does this happen? Why are there spirals and triangles and pentagons and so forth in nature? And I never found it. And I thought to myself, oh, my gosh, I might have to write it. So I kept on collecting information, organizing my thoughts. And I had to teach myself how to write. You know, when I was a kid in school in the 50s, the boys did math and science and the girls were good at English and so on. Remember those days?
Exactly. The split between me and my brother. Yes, I remember it well.
So I didn't really have any insights into writing. So I kept on trying to learn and organize my thoughts. And the first versions of this book were all handwritten and hand illustrated like a medieval manuscript. It was a lot of fun. And my studies widened out from nature to art, because some of the greats, you know, Leonardo da Vinci, Albrecht Dürer, Raphael, and then in every culture, in China, in Africa, in India, South America, Native America, everybody had a tradition about numbers. And so there were, and some of these traditions were not culturally taught. In other words, that it wasn't something that was true in one culture but not in another. These were, capital T truths, mm-hmm. true everywhere, all times, to all people. And that's what I was interested in. And so I eventually found an agent, John Brockman in New York City.
Oh, I used to know John, yeah.
Oh, wow. He's something else. What a rare being. And they backed me on this, and HarperCollins published it, and it came out in 94, the fall of 94, A Beginner's Guide to Constructing the Universe. And the book was, the title was a gift from my friend and mentor, the late John Michel, who wrote some wonderful, The View Over Atlantis, The Earth Spirit, so on and so on. I recommend anything by him. And it just took off. And it's been in print for 20 years, thank goodness. And I was able to organize the book in chapters. Each chapter is about that number. Chapter one about the number one in the circle. Chapter two about number two. And I went through the single digits, 1 through 9, which really represent principles. Mm-hmm. As you said earlier, we learn that numbers are quantities. We use them for counting and for measuring and weighing and calculating and so on. But besides being quantities, there's a long tradition of numbers as qualities, as symbols. In other words, one, symbolized by the circle, is a... everybody knows that it's about wholeness, completeness, unity, oneness, and that two is about polarity, conflict or cooperation, and so on. And so these are the...
What I suddenly thought of is that two gives you choice suddenly.
That's right. Two gives you choice. Mm. You have diversity that comes with the number two. It doesn't come with one. One is about... unity, all one, no differences, wholeness.
I also often think about that when there are people who want to be like loving forever, like all you will ever know is connectedness. But if all you ever know is connectedness, there's no differentiation, there's no variety, there's nothing to experience. You have to move on, even if you're going to eventually return to one. You have to move on, for the full experience.
And the full experience is through all the numbers, 1 through 9. Yeah. That's what this book is about, 1 through 9. And I wrote about the principles for them because they're deep inside of us. They're not out there. They're principles that we know about. And then I went to number 10. I finished the book with number 10 because it's a sort of return to unity, mm-hmm. but at a lower scale. Mm-hmm. People think of one as a low number. To me, one is the highest number. It's the supreme number. It encompasses everything. All geometry, all geometric shapes can be found within the circle. It holds them all, encompasses them all. So I went 1 to 10. And with the DVD, Journey from 1 to 12, I expanded it to 12.
Yeah, I was surprised to see that. What made you bring it all the way out to 12?
Well, if you want to know about all the basic principles, you just need to go 1 to 9. But if you understand 1 to 12 and... their multiples and powers, you can understand very easily any of the designs that you find throughout the universe. Mm. Think of the long tradition of 12 in mythology and religion, mm-hmm. 12 disciples, 12
months to the year,
12 months, 12 inches, 12 labors of Hercules. The Dalai Lama has 12 advisors. The 12s don't end. The ancient Greek government was built around 12s. Jason and the 12 ships of the Argonaut. Well, why is it 12? Why not 10, mm-hmm. for example? Well, 12 is so very, very interesting. I mean, as a number, it's a small number that has the most divisors. Mm-hmm. So you buy a dozen eggs. They can be divided into halves, thirds, fourths, sixths, so on. 10, you can't do that. And so with 12, you really got all the designs. Mm-hmm. You've got everything. You don't have to go into... too much past that because they're really all based on 12s. Now, we count by 10s, And we organize numbers by tens, hundreds, thousands. But numbers organize themselves by 12s. If you look at the inherent structure, there's something called versatile numbers. You know, if you look at the numbers that will divide into any number, every time there's another divisor added, it's a multiple of 12. Mm-hmm. You see, so 12 provides a kind of a skeleton for all numbers. Mm-hmm. So it was worthwhile to approach it that way.
Maybe it alludes to the fact that perhaps at some time we had six fingers, not five. Who knows?
Well, who knows? Yeah. There are cats and dogs that are, you know, come about with six fingers and so on. But,
you know, this is a little off the subject, but I wanted to ask you about this. I was recently reading a book about Venice, and it talked about this battle between two very famous mathematicians and where there would be public debates. And what would happen was, and this happened around the solving of the equation for the cube, you know, like who came up with it first. And the way the contest would work is each mathematician would construct 30 problems to give the other mathematician. But he had to be able to solve all 30 himself. He couldn't give a problem he couldn't solve.
Uh-huh.
And whoever solved them the shortest amount of time won. And in this particular case, there was, I think, a Venetian who won the contest because he'd figured out the other person had figured out only one form of the cube that he could solve, and this guy had figured out them all. So the guy who had only figured out one gave the other guy only one kind, and this guy gave him a whole variety of kinds to solve. And then there was a whole, then this guy tried to steal his and publish it. It was a whole thing. But this idea of mathematical debate being a public thing where people came from all over and attended, when did mathematics become more private?
You know, what you're talking about is interesting. I've read about these mathematical contests. They're usually sponsored by the king. Mm-hmm. He'd have a court mathematician and so on. Leonardo of Pisa, known as Fibonacci, was one of these. And you may be thinking about his.
No, it wasn't.
Wasn't
it
him?
No, it wasn't. It was somebody else whose name I don't remember. But,
right. Yeah. Well, when did it change? I would say when somehow we lost the idea of mathematics as related to philosophy and it got into a business. This was really with the in the Middle Ages.
When it became only about measuring and counting.
Yeah. And business.
Yeah.
It came about with the switch from the Roman numerals, at least in Europe, mm-hmm. Switch from the Roman numerals to the so-called the modern Arabic or Hindu-Arabic numerals, because it was so useful in business. Schools opened up throughout Europe to teach business techniques using these new numbers that make calculating very easy. You know, Roman numerals, how do you multiply Roman numerals? You have to use an abacus.
Mm-hmm. And didn't Fibonacci play a major role?
He was it.
Yeah.
He was it. He was born about late 1100s, and his father was the head of the Merchants Association in Pisa. And his father took him to North Africa, to Algeria, when he was about five or so. And because they had a warehouse, the Pisan merchants had a warehouse in North Africa for the trading and all. And his father said, well, you're going to be a businessman, and so you need a tutor. So they got him a math tutor and who was a Muslim fellow. And the Arabs who were across North Africa at the time had traded with India. They learned the Arabic numerals, the 0 through 9, and place values, 1s, 10s, 100s. And so little Leonardo learned both methods, Roman numerals and the Hindu-Arabic numerals. And he saw how superior the Hindu-Arabic numerals were for counting, calculating, and so forth. So he traveled around on business, and he collected examples of how to use numbers in business. And he wrote a book, Liber Abaci, The Book of Calculation, around 1200. And it showed both ways of calculating. Here's how you do it in Roman numerals. Here's how you do it in the Hindu-Arabic numerals. How to convert currencies between different types of coins, and how to percentages, and you know, all everything a business person would need. And the book caught on in Europe, and it was it became really popular. And the bankers wanted to start using it. I mean, the business people wanted to use it. But the resistance came from the new industries of banking and insurance. The banker said, no, we're not going to these newfangled numerals. You could turn a 1 into a 7. You could turn a 3 into an 8. We're not fooling around with this. This is, don't even think about it. We're staying with the Roman numerals. No, we don't want forgery. So there's debate about it and so on. And the solution to it came with something that we still do today. You know, when you write a check, we write the numerals, but we also spell it out.
Yeah.
That was the compromise. As long as you can spell it out on the check, everybody was happy going to the new numerals. So he played the role. This little boy wound up transforming the numerals of the entire world.
And then I want to come back to the qualities of individual numbers. But let's also, since we've brought up Fibonacci, go to the Fibonacci series and what it is and how he discovered it and what's, first of all, what is it and what's so special about it?
Well, with the so-called Fibonacci sequence or series, it's just a simple number series that starts with 0 and 1, nothing and something.
Okay. And I'm going to pull you back. When did 0 become a number? I mean, when was it realized that we needed a number for nothing?
Well, you find that it actually first appears with the Babylonians. They had number columns that we do too. Mm-hmm. We go 1, 10, 100,000. They went 1, 60, 3,600. They counted by 60s.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's because they were very much involved in astronomical studies. And when you work with 60, not only are you working with all the greatness of 12, but you bring in 5. 5 times 12 is 60. So with that, 360 has so many divisors. 60 has so many divisors. So they would write in columns, and whenever there was nothing in the 60s place, they'd either leave it blank or put a little raised dot there.
Mm-hmm.
The Hindus picked that up, and they made the 0 sign. The Mayans also had it, but it goes back pretty far.
Mm-hmm.
0 is a nothing that represents a something that represents nothing. It's not considered a number, really.
Mm.
It's not certainly not a natural, quote, natural number of the natural numbers, because where is it? What is it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm holding 0 elephants in my hand right now. But it is pretty fascinating. It's like the egg that gives birth to everything in a way.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the Fibonacci series.
All right. 0 and 1. And the rule is each next term is the sum of the two previous. So 0 plus 1, make 1.
So the first three terms would be 0, 1, and 1?
Yeah.
Okay, got
and
it.
Then the 1 and 1 make 2. And let's see, 1 and 1 make 2.
2 and 1 make 3.
2 and 1 make 3.
Yeah.
2 and 3 make 5. 3 and 5, 8.
Yeah.
5, 8, 13, 21, 34. And these are the numbers that show up as the numbers of petals and flowers. At least that's what nature aims at.
Yeah.
You see, so...
So do you have any idea, do we know, did he have notebooks, how he started fooling around with this? What drew him to it?
It wasn't a big thing in his mind. It was one, it was simply, it came about as just one math situation out of hundreds in his book. He collected puzzles as well as examples of business. And there was what's called the rabbit puzzle. And this goes back. It may have come from, somewhere in the Middle East, Egypt or somewhere. It says if you start with a pair of newborn rabbits, a male and a female, on January 1st, and if they undergo ideal situations, in other words, they take exactly 30 days to mature, at which point they mate, and it takes exactly 30 days to gestate. And if each female gives birth to another pair just like themselves, a male and a female, see, these are ideal, that next month, and they mate again, the original pair mate, and the new pair takes another month to mature, then they mate, and so on and so forth. His question was, how many pair would you have after a year? Well, you can work it out by drawing little stick figures and so on. It would take you forever. And you can try Roman numerals. You'll go crazy with it. But he said, if you put it in terms of these Hindu Arabic numerals, you can see the pattern. Each two numbers adds to make the next.
Uh-huh.
And then he went on to the next set of puzzles and so on. It was very obscure.
Uh-huh.
It was only noticed a few hundred years later. by some mathematicians who began to explore this very interesting series. And then people started noticing it in nature. You know, if you look at a pine cone and you count the numbers of spiral rows of those bracts going around in each direction, one direction will be one Fibonacci number, like maybe five rows going around. And in the other direction, the same exact bracts, there'll be eight of them, or 8 and 13, 13, 21, and flower petals, and pineapple fruitlets. And anywhere you see spirals, you're pretty much going to find these. And so now it's tremendous study.
Yeah. And why do you think nature works in spirals? What's the efficiency of that?
It's dynamic balance. Mm-hmm. You know, if you want something that's going to stand still to balance, you build a triangle. Mm-hmm. So you see houses and bridges and so forth.
So you go into that beautifully in the number three.
Yeah, that's about number
three. Which we will come back to the numbers. Yeah.
Oh, I love number three. Yeah. I love them all. But and so a spiral is about balance in motion. As something is growing, the spiral that's made by these, the so-called golden spiral, comes about and grows in such a way that if you took a little piece of it, picture that spiral, mm-hmm. okay, like you see in the hurricanes, mm-hmm, for mm-hmm. example, or little plant tendrils or mm-hmm, however many mm-hmm. places. Make your fist, you'll see it there. Mm-hmm. If you would take a piece of that spiral mm-hmm. and enlarge it or shrink it, mm-hmm. there's another part of that same golden spiral that it'll fit on. Mm-hmm. That's the only spiral that'll do that.
Uh-huh.
So it changes, but it doesn't change.
So it's sort of fractal in a way?
It exactly yeah. fractal. It's yeah. the essence of fractals. Mm-hmm. So when a nautilus shell or any of these shelled creatures are growing, when it's very small, it learns how to balance a certain way, you see?
Balance in terms of its relationship to gravity?
To gravity.
Yeah.
Upright, floating yeah. in the water, you know, uh-huh. so it can look out over its yes. little shell
yes.
there. As it grows larger and heavier, it doesn't have to relearn to balance. The center of gravity stays at the same spot at the eye.
So it's still orienting.
It's still oriented without having to rebalance. And this is the key to animals that have horns. As the horns get larger and larger and heavier, the animal doesn't have to learn how to rebalance its head. The center of gravity is exactly the same in this spiral.
So they are the golden, the horns spiral out in the golden spiral based on the Fibonacci numbers.
Yep, they do.
Yeah.
See, I mentioned the term golden here, and I didn't say Fibonacci spiral. What happens is if you take two consecutive Fibonacci numbers, 5 and 3, 8 and 5, 13 and 8, and so forth, and divide them, you can use a calculator, they get closer and closer and closer to an ideal, which is called the golden mean, the golden balance. That's where that comes about. They're related, but the golden mean, the golden ratio, is the ideal that the Fibonacci numbers are reaching for mm-hmm. ever ahead.
And who named it the golden mean? How did it come up? What was that idea?
Well, I think the 1800s, somebody in Germany, the goldener Schnitt, mm-hmm. the golden cut.
Mm-hmm.
See, if you want to see where the golden ratio is, just look at your arm. If you look at what's called the cubit, the ancient
yes.
cubit, from the elbow to the fingertips,
yeah.
you see, where your wrist is yeah. divides that in a certain place.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that the whole forearm, in other words, elbow to fingertip, is to the large section, elbow to wrist, as the large section is to the size of the hand.
Uh-huh.
So there's a balance between the whole, the large part, and the small part. And that mathematical balance is important in, let's say, the plant world.
And those are Fibonacci numbers?
They are, you can look at them as Fibonacci numbers, mm-hmm. like say, if the whole arm would say is, let's say, 21 inches,
mm-hmm.
this part will be about 13, this will be about 8.
Got it.
Fibonacci is always approximations.
Yes, yeah.
And so if you consider a tree, which is a whole made of large parts, and the large parts have small parts on them. You know, the big boughs have branches, the branches have twigs, the twigs have leaves, and so forth. Every one of their relationships of whole to large to small part is going to be in this relationship. So it stays balanced
mm-hmm.
without having to tilt over.
Mm-hmm.
Ever wonder why such complex trees. Uh-huh. They don't tilt over. Mm-hmm. Why don't all the branches form on one side?
Yeah.
Because they're spiraling in this Fibonacci method or manner. And so they maintain balance no matter how big they get. The whole tree does. The branches do. The twigs do. The thorns do. Everything stays in balance by this mathematics.
Which may be one reason that it's very pleasing and satisfying for us to look at them.
We seem to be pleased by harmony,
Yeah. Whether
it's in music or visual studies or food. There's harmonious relationships, and they touch deep into us. We recognize them mm-hmm. from deep within.
This is Hot Tech Cool Science. I'm your host, Julie Motz. Well, actually, it's Art's Desire. Sorry. Hot Tech Cool Science is next week, but we are talking about numbers with Michael Schneider. He is the author of a wonderful book, A Beginner's Guide to Constructing the Universe, and two great DVDs, Constructing the Universe, A Journey from 1 to 12, and Fibonacci Garden, Mathematics in the Plant World. And we will be back talking again with Michael very, very soon. Well, hello again. The program is Art's Desire. I'm your host, Julie Motz. And that little bit of Handel was just to alert you to that a very rarely performed Handel opera, Aria Dante, is going to be performed at the Exit Theater, not this weekend, but next weekend. It's spelled A-R-I-O-D-A-N-T-A. If you just Google Aria Dante, you'll get all the details of the upcoming performance at the Exit Theater, and a wonderful tenor named Jonathan Schmucker is going to be performing in that, and he's the person who told me about that. And now back to the world of numbers and art and nature with our guest, Michael Schneider. We were talking about spirals and the Fibonacci spirals, and you may not have an answer to this. It's a kind of a philosophical question, but it's occurred to me that there are spirals of time in our lives where at least we have the feeling of returning to the same issues of the same place, but at a different point in time, in an advanced time. And I wonder if anybody has ever kind of clocked the time cycle of events or significant repeats in anybody's life. I mean, have you ever tried to do that with your life, for example?
You know, that is an interesting idea.
Or maybe the appearance of significant events. Do they appear on this kind of spiral?
I never really mapped it out. But I know that, at least I feel, that we do, it's not a circle, but a spiral. We get to the something similar, something resonant, something resonates at different times in our life. In other words, we get move along, we're in a different place, but it's something similar.
Yeah.
So I don't know. People talk about rhythms, like 7-year cycles and other cycles.
It would be interesting to see if does something significant happen at the age of 1, 2, 3. I mean, if you could do that. I've never even thought about this before looking at your DVD, but that would be something that would be intriguing. You also talk about Fibonacci numbers and flow, how flows of liquid, movements of things.
They're the spirals. Mm-hmm. Water moves in rhythms. It won't move in a straight line. If you leave it alone, if you leave just about anything alone in nature, it'll wind up moving in waves and spirals. And so if a wave is or a flow is disrupted, by a rock in the stream, or if you're rowing a boat, and you look behind the oar, you'll see alternating spirals going around. What happens is a spiral is a way that nature brings balance back to a system, a situation. In other words, the water was disrupted, it was blocked, but due to the spirals, it comes back to balance. Mm-hmm. And that's nature's, really, it's kind of a healing tool in nature to bring balance back to a situation through the spiral path. Mm-hmm. See, so, and there are a lot of examples, in a breeze. If you could imagine a breeze passing by a tree, the tree splits it, and it's just like the spirals in the water. The air will spiral around. You've seen leaves whirling around and so on. It's nature bringing the flow back to balance.
My mind, as you were talking, just went to music, and I was just thinking within the octave, which of course is 8, was the Fibonacci. You have thirds and fifths, which are the most important, the chords where you feel like at home, musically when you hear them. So there's something about that too.
Well, some of the great musicians have employed the Fibonacci number rhythms. For example, Béla Bartók, who went around collecting folk music, and he found these certain rhythms that keep showing up. And the way he wrote, he would write in Fibonacci numbers of bars. Mm-hmm. You know, something would build through the, you know, at the 13th, 21st bar, 34th, to a big crescendo at the 55th, and down to the 89th. And what he did was something so interesting. The piece I'm thinking of is, a fugue for Celesta and violin. And the proportions of a violin are the proportions of a human body.
Huh.
Yeah. Where the neck meets the body is where the belly button divides the body.
Mm-hmm.
And it's where the wrist divides the arm.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way he wrote was... the whole piece is a human body in miniature,
mm-hmm.
you see. And not only that, it's the proportions of the violin that's playing the music, and it's the proportions of the arm that's holding the violin that plays the music. So people have applied Fibonacci rhythms to music, although the musical scale, the octave, at least the Western musical scale. You know, in fact, around the world, there are certain musical relationships that remain the same. In other words, the octave, the musical third, the fourth, and the tone, they're the anchors everywhere around the world. How the rest is divided up, you know, you could have 22 in India,
mm-hmm.
or 13 and so on. But there are certain anchors to it. I wouldn't call them Fibonacci per se in the way that the notes build. But it's truly a mathematical set of harmonies that are coming together. It is too technical to go into right now.
No, I was just thinking of the sort of the peacefulness of the musical third, the musical fifth, and the octave. That to me, those are the three
those are the universal ones.
Feel the most kind of soothing.
Yeah, simple numbers. Well, you're coming from Pythagoras now, mm-hmm. who wrote about, you know, he's considered the first empirical physicist because he studied... vibrating strings, that if you take a whole string, you've got a note. At two-thirds, you've got the musical fifth. You've got at three-quarters, you've got the fourth. And at the halfway point, you've got the octave. So you're dealing with the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4. 1 over 2 makes the octave, 2 over 3, 3 over 4. These are the basic relations in music, at least mathematically.
That, of course, is Michael Schneider. He is the author of A Beginner's Guide to Constructing the Universe. And these two DVDs, Constructing the Universe and Fibonacci Garden. Michael, if people want to get these DVDs, how do they go about doing that? Where can I find them?
Well, they go to my website.
Okay,
that's the only place that they're available. Unless you get to the... No, actually, that's the only place they're available at constructingtheuniverse.com.
That's easy. And again, if you forget, you can email me, juliemotz@juliemotz.com, and I will give you the information. The Fibonacci Garden has gorgeous photograph after gorgeous photograph of plants and flowers. Did you take all those photographs yourself?
Many I did.
They're spectacular.
Many I did. Wherever I travel, I take a camera, and there are some fantastic, beautiful plants everywhere. I mean, I'm walking outside the station here, and I'm looking at all the beautiful fives and the threes and the spiraling lilacs and so on everywhere. Just it's a matter of opening our eyes and seeing what is.
Yes. And since you've exposed me to it through the DVD, I've actually started looking at, you know, I'm getting
uh-huh.
excited about looking at turning over my lettuce and looking at the bottom.
Oh, isn't that wonderful? You see the big five-pointed star?
Yes. Yeah.
Five is about life. Let me organize the say it this way. If we consider the numbers 1 through 12,
mm-hmm.
they organize themselves naturally into four groups. The numbers 1 and 2 you might call first principles. They get things going. In other words, unity and polarity. That the yin-yang, you can think of
mm-hmm.
it like that.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing will move until there's two going on, like mm-hmm. 2 feet. Or,
mm-hmm.
You know, if you pick up a rubber band, it's like a circle. It's a hole. It sits there. But if you want to shoot it, you have to pull both ends.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you hold one end still and the other end moves back and then it'll go. It's like chopsticks. One stands still, one goes. It's like that. Or geometric compass. One point stands still on the paper, one goes around. So when you have two, You got things going.
You have movement, in short. There's no movement with just one.
Right. You have movement. Right. No movement with one. One is one. Then you get what are called the numbers of structure. 3, 4, 6, 8, and 12. Geometrically as the triangle, square, hexagon, octagon, dodecagon. Not only does nature build with these, but engineers. I mean, it's facts of nature, so you can't avoid it. And so these are the numbers of structure. Nature builds with them. Engineers build with them.
Do you want to talk about the difference between the triangle and the square in terms of structure and what kind of feeling we get from them between 3 and 4?
Well, with 3, you're talking Buckminster Fuller. Mm-hmm. Dear Buckminster Fuller. And geodesics. 3 is about a structure. You know, if you build something with a triangle, it's solid. Mm-hmm. Build with a square, it can tilt. You have to brace it, see. Mm-hmm. But it's at right angles to the ground, and it feels right. 3 has some other interesting properties as well. I'd like to point out that when you have 3, what very often you're looking at is two opposites balanced by a third.
Like two parents with a child in between.
Two parents and a child. Or two people and a relationship. Mm-hmm. Without a relationship, you just have two individuals, see. Or you can take it to nature. For example, every atom, solids, liquid gases, plasma, electrified gas, except for hydrogen, which is a proton and electron. They're perfectly in balance. But beyond that, they have to have the neutron. The electron is very, very tiny. Negative charge. The proton's very large relatively to it. Positive charge. If it was just them or a bunch of them, they'd crash opposites attract and the universe would just crunch down. But you have the neutral neutron. It doesn't lean this way. It doesn't lean that way. But that neutrality holds it all in balance. Mm-hmm. That's the idea of the 3. You've got a polarity and a balance. And so you find this just about everywhere else. For example, in a courtroom, you've got the prosecution, guilty, 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 defense, innocent, innocent, innocent. They go back and forth all day. But you have that, theoretically, neutral judge and jury who bring balance to the whole situation. Mm-hmm. And so people have done all sorts of...
And they're all Fibonacci numbers. The judge is 1, the lawyers are 2, the jury is 13.
Yeah, 12.
I'm sorry, 12.
Right, there's that 12 again.
Yeah.
12 again. I mean, it's even in the design of the United States government. The polarity, you got 3 parts. You've got the executive branch or president and the legislative Congress and the judicial, the Supreme Court. The... president is 1, the Congress is many. It's like that little itty bitty electron and the giant proton. They're the polarity. They have to clash. They're supposed to clash. Mm-hmm. If they're getting along, be a little wary. Mm-hmm. And whenever there's a dispute, the Supreme Court brings it to balance. Yeah. But an even more interesting one is the idea of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Mm-hmm. Hear about that. The opposite poles are life and liberty. Life is what we have to do. Liberty is what we want to do. You know, life, what we have to do. We have to eat, sleep, get dressed, bathe, go to work, all the things we have to do. Liberty is whatever we want to do. Oh, I want to travel. I want to read. I want to do my art. But it's their balance, their dynamic balance that is our own pursuit of happiness.
It's interesting because originally it was life, liberty, and property.
And property, right.
Interesting that happiness was put in as a better balance.
It is a better balance.
Between life and liberty than property.
Yes, I know that. I've thought about that. Happiness is much better. And it's, at least for certain things anyway, and it's dynamic. It's a balance. It's due to the how we balance our life and liberty. You don't want to do everything that you just have to do and not what you want to do. And you can't certainly get along with just doing what you want to do and not what you have to do. You have to have responsibilities and so forth. But it's that dynamic balance. But that's the idea of 3. Mm-hmm. It's 2 opposites and a balance, you see. And you find that in nature as well.
Like the scales of justice.
The scales of justice, right. Mm-hmm. Right.
Or any scales for that matter.
Scales. I give a lot of examples of this in the Journey from 1 to 12 DVD when you get to number 3. Mm-hmm. And there's so much more. I mean, example after example. So those
Holy
are the,
Trinity. I mean,
Trinities. Well, see, with Trinity, well, with one, you have a unity.
Mm-hmm.
Two breaks that unity. But with three, the unity is restored. For example, if you have two strands of hair and you twirl them around each other, they'll just unfurl. But with three,
you can make a braid.
You can make a braid, which is an ongoing knot, a solid.
Yeah.
So three restores unity when it was lost in the polarity, you see. And lots of examples of that.
Yeah.
So these numbers of structure, 3, 4, 6, 8, and 12. Then you get the numbers 5 and 10, which are numbers of life. Wherever you find life, most likely, not always, but most likely you're going to find a 5 in there. You know, look at the five fingers or the five senses or the, you know, five-petaled flowers are the most prevalent. Starfish. And it's also about regeneration. You know, if a starfish loses an arm, the body will regenerate, because that's what five is about. Mm-hmm. It reproduces its own version, the pentagram shape. Mm-hmm. It reproduces itself in miniature, and it shows up in nature by regeneration. And not only that, the starfish will not only grow a new arm, but if that arm had a piece of the central nervous system in it, the arm will regenerate a whole body, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So five is generally about life, five and 10.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get the numbers 7, 9, and 11. These would be called numbers of mystery.
And what is the mystery?
Well, first of all of the numbers 1 through 12 can be constructed geometrically with a compass and a straight edge. You know, you can make a nice triangle or a pentagon or a hexagon and so forth. But 7, 9, and 11 cannot.
So you can't, with a compass and a straight edge, make a 7-sided figure or a 9-sided figure or an 11-sided figure.
Not a regular one where everything's equal. Uh-huh. It cannot be done.
Uh-huh. And I'm sure there's a mathematical proof to demonstrate that.
There are mathematical proofs for that.
Yeah.
And so wherever you find these numbers, there's something interesting going on. For example, with 7, think of the 7s, like the 7 colors of the rainbow. You can see it, but you can't grab it.
Mm-hmm.
Same with the 7 notes of the musical scale. You can hear it. You know, as John Michel once said, nobody ever had to sweep up after listening to music. You know, it's there, but it's not there. This is what the numbers of mystery are about, 7, 9, and 11.
Mm-hmm.
You see, so the numbers 1 through 12 organize themselves naturally into those groups.
Mm-hmm. So say a little more about 7, 9, and 11, where they pop up in their mystery. What?
Oh, well, 7 always involves something interesting. Whether it's the beauty of the rainbow, which can't be held.
7 deadly sins, 7 cardinal virtues.
Yeah. Well, 7 is an unusual number in the 12. For example, in ancient times in Greece, it was called the virgin number. Because with other numbers, they interrelate. You know, 2 relates to 4, 6, 8. You know, 3, 6, and 9 relate. 5 and 10 relate. They all relate, and they all relate to one.
Mm-hmm.
One is everybody's friend,
mm-hmm.
you know. But one is unity is hidden. In other words, if you multiply any number by one, it remains the number.
Mm-hmm.
If you divide any number by one, it remains the number. But number one is in there. Unity is in everything. So 7 relates to one, but that's the only one. So because no number divides into it,
mm-hmm.
it was called the virgin number.
Mm-hmm.
And so in ancient Greece, if you find virgin goddesses like Athena, you'll find 7 associated with with her in tales or dimensions of things and so on. 9 is a funny number. You can't construct it you'd think you could. If you can make a triangle, why can't you make a triple triangle?
Mm-hmm.
But it can't be done. 9 doesn't show up too much in structures. It does show up in cells, in the centrosomes.
Mm-hmm.
They're these 9 tubes,
mm-hmm.
but only a very few places. And 11, forget it. You're not going to find it in architecture. You're not going to find it in music. What 11 is about is relationships. 11 is about the in-between. You know, it's between the great two systems of 10 and 12.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a doorway.
Mm-hmm.
Between them, or like it's like two ones look like two columns that you pass through. And so with 11, you find it in relationships. For example, the traditional approximation of pi, 22/7. 22 is the double 11. Mm-hmm. And there are other examples of how 11 helps numbers relate to each other, but itself doesn't really manifest.
You know, I was just thinking about, you know, that we've lost this relationship, this quality relationship to number, you know, and it's been reduced to quantity, to measuring and counting. But, you know, people have tried to bring it back in a certain way through various forms of numerology, where, you know, you convert the letters of your name into numbers, they add up, and that means something. But the meanings never are these fundamental meanings that you've discussed.
Yeah, see, when people talk about numerology, I say, well, I'm interested in nature's numerology. I mean, I look at humanly devised systems, and I'm interested in them. But, you know, when it comes down to having a final word, it's nature's so forth numerology. In other words, nature and mathematics are both the capital T truths. They don't change. Today's Thursday. It's a small T truth, but it won't be true tomorrow. But numbers, numbers, shapes, and nature are the capital T truths, and that's where I stay. I feel safest staying with those, because I can point to it. Everybody sees it. Everybody agrees. See.
So I mentioned earlier in the show about sacred geometry, which is how I found you first. I wish I could remember her name. Her first name is Molly. Do you know the sacred geometry woman in the Bay Area?
Yeah. I know her. She used to come to my workshops. I used to go to her as an artist.
Yes.
Did
yeah.
great things with mirrors. Oh, Molly, gosh, I haven't thought of her in years. Hi, Molly.
Well, anyway, what I wanted to bring up is that she would construct things, mostly these pyramids, you know, and maybe I was just highly suggestible, but I felt that when I sat under them, I actually felt something energetic. Have you fooled around with having different shapes over your head, standing inside different shapes and seeing how it feels?
No, I haven't done that. Many, many, many years ago.
You've stayed on the side of sanity, in other
well,
words.
Well, it could be. I mean, I'm not saying no. I mean, I read Patrick Flanagan's books, you know, decades ago, The Great Pyramid or Pyramid Power and so forth.
Yes.
And I study the geometry of the pyramid. Quite interesting. The Egyptians were such great mathematicians, you know. And I point some of this out to my students these days. I teach at California College of the Arts. And I really enjoy when people say, what do you do? On purpose, I say, I teach math to art students, and I get the same answer every time. Oh, those poor, sensitive art students have to take a math class. Oh, those poor kids. But you know what? What I do is I teach them about not only the mathematics of nature, but how the great artists, architects, designers of the past and in every culture have used it. And so by the end of the course, they're saying, this is the best course I've taken in a long time. It's really practical.
Well, the discovery of the laws of perspective, which is basically a mathematical discovery, was a huge breakthrough for Western art. I mean, it was a technological revolution.
Absolutely. Mathematics, whether we want to use it or not, it's there. Mm-hmm. We can ignore it, but understanding that certain proportions have certain effects on us, they have certain feel to them. You know, if you do something on a square canvas, it's different from a golden rectangle canvas.
Yes,
you
mentioned like the 3x5 card, 3 and 5 both being Fibonacci
numbers, and 5x8.
And why that feels so right to us, and why we automatically create shapes like that.
Yeah, we do a lot of it unconsciously.
It makes me wonder if the shape of our peripheral vision somehow matches a Fibonacci number. I mean,
Fibonacci shows up when there's growth, generally. Mm-hmm. Not always, but when there's growth. Mm-hmm. Growth that needs to balance no matter how big or small it is. Mm-hmm. And that's why it shows up in the plant world and the animal world and, you know, planet solar systems. The solar system is essentially the same proportions as a human being. You know, it's just, it grows. In other words, if you look at the bones of your fingers, mm-hmm. you notice how each two bones equals the length of the next bone mm-hmm. for the 1, 2, 3, 4 mm-hmm. bones. Mm-hmm. And for at least the inner planets of the solar system, there's Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars. They're like the joints and the bones of our finger mm-hmm. in our hand. Mm-hmm. It's like a huge body. So wherever there's change that needs to maintain balance, you'll find Fibonacci numbers, spirals. and like that.
So I want to ask you a kind of personal question. In decorating your own home, did you find yourself creating certain proportions consciously or unconsciously that, you know, that had this mathematical dynamic to them?
No. Right. No. I'd drive myself crazy if I did that kind of thing. You know, that's like too obsessive. I like randomness. Uh-huh. I like a little disorder here and there. It's why a city needs a park. Uh-huh. You have to have that disorder and that random aspect. I know people who do that sort of thing, but I don't find it helpful or useful, or I don't like it that much. I don't want that much order.
So harmony has to be disrupted to be enjoyed.
There has to be something. There has to be elbow room. Mm-hmm. You know, even with nature, even though nature aims for these numbers in flower petals, you'll find other numbers, like, you know, lots of daisies will say I'll have 13 petals. Mm-hmm. You'll find some 14s. You'll find some 12s. Mm-hmm. Now, on average, in a field, they'll average to 13. But there has to be those differences. I don't like such rigidity.
Okay. Well, we have been talking with the anything but rigid Michael Schneider. He's the author of A Beginner's Guide to Constructing the Universe and two wonderful DVDs, Constructing the Universe, A Journey from 1 to 12, and Fibonacci Garden, Mathematics in the Plant World. And these can be found at constructingtheuniverse.com.
And I'd also like to add that I wrote 6 workbooks for people who want hands-on experience for themselves or their kids. Mm-hmm. On doing all the constructions from 1 to 12. Plus, there's another volume 3 is about the golden mean and the Fibonacci numbers. And volume 4 is about what are called dynamic rectangles, that certain rectangles have different mathematical properties that artists have appreciated. Number 5 is called Constructing the Cosmological Circle, which is a very interesting diagram. There's a whole nother hour of talk. But a great deal has been designed with that. And number 6, volume 6, is sort of a toy in a way. It's called Secret Windows into Nature, Art, Science, and Technology. It comes with a sheet of acetate that holds all the different geometric constructions on them. And I have you lay them on different pictures. So you could see
paintings,
paintings, forms of nature, art, and design, and so forth. So it's kind of you play with it. You know, you don't have to turn a compass. But I love turning a compass.
And all these found at Michael Schneider's website, constructingtheuniverse.com. Thank you, Michael, for opening this wonderful world of numbers to us.
I can't tell you how delighted I am, Julie. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thanks for listening to Art's Desire. Please tune in next week for Hot Tech Cool Science.